My name is Aaron Westog. I'm one of the directors of LSC Ideas with Professor Michael Cox. And it's a great pleasure for me to welcome all of you to the seminar this evening. We are particularly fortunate to have the Ambassador of the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela, Dr. Samuel Moncada, with us tonight. And Your Excellency, you're most welcome to LSE Ideas and for a presentation on Venezuela's Bolivarian process, achievements, challenges, and prospects of the 10 years. Now, Dr. Moncada does not just have an academic, a diplomatic background. He also has an academic background. In a way, this is a kind of homecoming in more than one sense, because you are not exclusively, at least mostly, I think, in ideas among fellow historians. Dr. Moncada got his PhD in modern history from Oxford University, where he studied at St. Anthony's College. And much of his career has been in higher education in Britain and in Venezuela. He also served as Venezuela's Minister of Higher Education from 2004 to 2007 before he came here to the UK as ambassador. So that kind of mixed background would prepare you perfectly for the kind of audience that would be here today. For comments on Dr. Moncada's presentation, we're very lucky to have with us Dr. Julia Buxton from University of Bradford, Department of Peace Studies there, who worked very widely on issues related to Latin America to Africa. She got a PhD here at LSE. On a thesis that dealt with the crisis of the Venezuelan party system. So there is a very direct connection here in terms of backgrounds and in terms of research interest between our main speaker, the ambassador, and Dr. Buxton, who will be commenting after the ambassador has spoken. So without further ado, again, Mr. Ambassador, most welcome to LSE Ideas, and we're looking forward to what you have to say.
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed for coming this afternoon to listen to us, knowing that there is a football match quite soon and you know, there is strong competition. And we were also told that there are some exams coming, so we know that you made an effort coming here today. Thank you for coming to listen to us. Before I begin, let me just offer you for your library a collection of Venezuelan films. They are in English. They are in Spanish, of course, but subtitled in English. And there are around 20 of them, different kind of films about art cinema or documentary. Documentaries about the political situation. Even some of them are not politically supportive of the government, but they may be of interest if you are interested in Venezuela or in Latin America, or even for practicing your Spanish to be.
And
as well, this book, which is written by Rod Stoneman, which is an Irish academic, and he also was the executive producer of a very famous documentary called The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. And the book is about the making of the film and also the consequences of the film, the political consequences of the afterwards of the film, and the political impact on the media debate about Venezuela. And the book has also the documentary in it. I mean, there's a DVD there. This book, which I think is a good introduction to Venezuela, is written by Charles Hardy. It's called Cowboy in Caracas. Charles Hardy was, I don't know if you have heard of him, but he was a Catholic priest, missionary really, living in Venezuela in the poorest areas of Caracas, or in Venezuela in fact, in the poorest slums of Caracas. And he lived there for 8 years, and he stopped living there, not because he wanted to, because the whole slum fell down the hills and it was destroyed. And but his experience about living among the Venezuelan poor is a good introduction to the economic contradictions in the Venezuelan society. And this one is another important book written by another former Catholic priest, perhaps you have heard of it, Bart Jones, and he even worked with Charles Hardy, but he retired from priesthood before, and is living in New York, and he's written some more academic-oriented, he's about his life experiences, and this one is a more academic-oriented research, if you want to call it like that, about the situation and the process in Venezuela. This may be of interest for you if you want to dig further into Venezuela. Well, my main point, my main problem when I approach this kind of audiences is I don't know the level of knowledge that you have on Venezuela, and there may be some hidden experts here that may put me into trouble later. But my first assumption is that your level is light. I mean, you are not experts on Venezuela, and I need to give you some general ideas, but I'm trying to speak shorter, 20 minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes, the more. And if you have a special interest in some areas that I haven't touched, please go further and we can debate on them. So what I'm trying to explain now is what's going on in Venezuela and in Latin America as part of a process of social change, which is based in solving our social emergency, I would call it like that. But it's not really an emergency. It is an emergency. I still call it an emergency. But it's an emergency that has been going on for 300 years. In the sense that our social contradictions, social disparities, social inequalities are so big, so massive, that it's very difficult to have a peaceful society, a balanced society with that kind of inequalities. That's why part of the explanations of the Latin American violence, political violence, convulsions, political instability is precisely because of the social disparities, economic disparities. And there has been there for a long time, at least in the independence times, the promise that a republican society, or a society organized under the institutions of a republic, should be an equal society. And that's a promise that has never been fulfilled. But it's a promise that is there. I even remember always a speech by Martin Luther King that he said that the black people, African American population in the U.S., they were given by the founding fathers this blank check with the promise that they will be equal to the rest of the Americans. But every time they went to the bank, meaning to the government or to the rest of the society, to get that check paid, the check bounced, meaning that it was an empty promise. Well, more or less the same happens to the majorities in Latin America. And I will say that in Venezuela, that is quite clear. During the 19th century, we have more than 50 civil wars or civil conflicts with one massive civil war, similar to the civil war in the U.S. And in the 20th century, we have one of the longest dictatorships in Latin America, Juan Vicente Gomez, in 1908 until 1936. And part of our conflicts weren't resolved by institutional means, but by violence, by force. And I would argue that since 1936, at least, in Venezuela, and it's a clear date, the 14th of February of 1936, in Venezuela was born the idea that we should be a democracy. I mean, why do I say that particular date when we know that the ideas and processes in history and societies take a long time to take root into the imaginary of the majorities? It's because on that particular day, there was a massive riot in Caracas asking for freedom, and the riot was controlled by force, meaning shooting tens of people in Caracas during the morning of that day. And the very same people that were shot or received the bullets from the army, in the afternoon they reorganized themselves, and in larger numbers, more than 50,000 people came onto the streets of Caracas asking for freedom again and threatening to topple the government. And the government realized, even the president of the time said so, wrote so later, that he realized that he couldn't stop people disarmed, walking on the streets with a bloodbath, with artillery, because he was used to fight guerrillas, as in the 19th century, people with machetes or weapons or cannons. But these were disarmed people shouting, just asking for freedom. And he had to change tactics and strategies. And he said, well, we have to negotiate with them. And since then on, it's not that democracy was born in Venezuela, of course it wasn't, but the idea that Venezuela had to be a democratic country was there, and is still there today. It hasn't been defeated, even though there were dictatorships afterwards. But the ethos behind everyone, even with a bad conscience among the rulers, is that Venezuela has to be a democratic country. But the second point is that it's not democracy in the liberal sense, in the 19th century liberal sense, that is being freedom. Our sense of democracy is beyond that, is that it has to be just. Social justice has to be incorporated into the equation. It's not just freedom to speak, or freedom to organize, or freedom to walk on the streets, or to choose your job. It's also access to power, access to be listened to, access to the decision-making process, but it's also access to what is not just political rights, but social rights. You know better than me that political rights are low-cost rights, in the sense that sometimes they are really free for the state to maintain. I mean, if you want to shout on the streets, that costs almost nothing to the state or to the government. But if you think that health care is a right, well, someone has to pay. And if you think that housing is a right, someone has to pay. So social rights are different than political rights in the sense that they cost money and someone has to pay. But in Venezuela, we felt, and the society at the time felt, that it's not just the freedom to speak, but the access to have rights and social rights, not just political, in the sense to enjoy public goods as the upper classes used to have at the time. I mean, social equality is part of the thing here. And I'm talking that in 1936 you had the very first trade unions, women organizations, student organizations, business organizations, talking more or less along the same lines. Social equality, justice, and the rest. And that's a promise that in Venezuela has also been there, and that's a responsibility or duty for any kind of government, regardless of the ideology of the government, has to be aimed at least. At least they justify their action, in the political speech, that we are trying to be a more equal, a more modern, more democratic, freer society with our policies. Perhaps sometimes they are contradictory policies, but they are saying or seem to be aiming at that goals. That's an important thing to keep in mind, because, okay, who pays for that? Well, the problem is that in Venezuela, since 1917, we had oil, and that's another massive difference between Venezuela and the rest of Latin America. In an agricultural society, or pre-industrial society, like most of Latin American societies were, at the time, Venezuela included. During the 19th century, we wanted to be equal, but equal during the 19th century meant equality through land property, meaning land redistribution, splitting the massive land states from the colonial times and distributing them among the peasants. And part of the wars were exactly because of that. But as of 1917, I would say even as of 1926, oil became the most important commodity in our economy. And I say exactly 1926 because at that particular year, oil surpassed the rest of the agricultural exports altogether. Venezuela became an oil country. The main export of Venezuela was oil. During the 19th century, we exported what we called in Venezuela, what I call at least, dessert products, meaning sugar, coffee, cocoa, chocolate, these kind of things, sugar cane. But in the 20th century, we began to export oil, which became and still is the blood of the industrial world. And without that particular commodity, the modern world doesn't work. It meant that we became a strategic country within the industrial world, and within the decision making in the global sense, not just in the periphery of the world economy. That meant that we have oil rent. Oil rent, to say it in a perhaps blunt way, or brutal way, is more or less the same that you had an uncle that died and gave and left you an inheritance. It's more or less the same thing. You don't work for it, but you have plenty of money. And the oil rent is not produced by Venezuelan workers or Venezuelan society. We are just lucky because we had that oil there. And oil is scarce, or is in shortage in the rest of the world, and the international economy pays Venezuela that prime because they don't have oil. And that's why we have plenty of money that we don't produce, and we change from an agricultural society to an oil society, meaning that we became an urban society in 30, 40 years without passing through an industrial revolution. So we are today 90% urban, our peasant population is almost non-existent, and we haven't been through an industrial revolution, but we did that through oil. Oil, meaning it meant also that the state became the most important change agent in Venezuela. Today, still today, but it was more or less the same in 1940s, 1950s, if the state or the rulers of the state, government personnel, they would like to buy the whole private sector in Venezuela, they could do it. Because the private sector is not the main engine of growth in Venezuela, and it has never been during the 20th century. That's an important thing to say. It's not Chavez that is being a socialist man. If you realize how more or less how was the economy, the Venezuelan economy during the 1980s, you will see that the main or the most important economic sectors were public owned. You see, there was a massive private sector is waiting to be expropriated by Chavez. It's nothing to do. So this the other way around. The rest of the society, including the private sector, they were rentists, rent seekers, getting rent out of the state because the main income of Venezuela came through and still coming through oil. I'm coming through all these things just to tell you quickly that with all that money, our elites during the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, they enjoyed this oil boom, and the story of oil is exactly that one, is perhaps more acute than the normal capitalist story that is all boom and bust, but in the oil it's clear that there will be boom times with high oil prices, and you close your eyes and wait for it because the bust is coming as well. It happened in our more than 100 years, almost 100 years story or history of oil in Venezuela. We have been through many booms and busts, and today we are going through a new bust. But the point is that during the boom times, Venezuela grew, and we became a very rich country in Latin American terms. But during the bust times, well, we suffer, and what we, as you, there's a common phrase now among your politicians, which is, you didn't fix the roof during the when the sun was shining. Well, that's exactly the same thing in Venezuela. We, the elites, needed to fix the roof when the sun was shining, and they didn't. And every time the bus came, we suffered a new law and massive social disruption and massive political disruption and dissolution, I would say. The promise of the democratic government from 1958 onwards was to finish military dictatorship in Latin America, in Venezuela, which is disease in the whole of Latin America, and also achieving social justice or social equality through democratic means. Some interesting slogan. Peace meaning getting rid of the military. Peace through with social justice through democratic means, meaning freedom. And during the 1960s and 70s, that seemed that it was possible to achieve, and Venezuela became a kind of beacon for democracy in Latin America, most of all when most of Latin American countries were under dictatorships. But after the 1980s, or during the 1980s, the elites wasted that oil rent, and during the 1980s onwards, we suffer a massive, long period of bust, low prices, and we spent all the oil rent money, and more than that, we were heavily indebted. And during the 1980s and 90s, we had to go to the IMF in order to get some money in order to rearrange our economic problems. But the IMF policies of the time were basically the wild neoliberal policies that asked every small country to cut social services, health, education, housing, all kind of public expenditures, and also to pay private debt as if it were normal public debt. So there was a massive unfairness, very similar to the one you are feeling today here when the banks are being paid by the taxpayers and the poor are suffering. But we felt that. Long time ago, not now. We went through this period during the 1980s and 1990s. Even we had our own little financial meltdown in 1994. Most of our banks went bust, and their bankers ran away with the money, and we had to pay for that. So there was a massive, an increasing sense of frustration, and that democracy, as it was depicted during the 1950s and 60s, it wasn't good enough. So again, the pendulum between military dictatorship and democracy was there. And the answer that in Venezuela, we looked for an answer for 15 years, it's not that we found it right away, is we didn't like military dictatorship anymore. And we didn't like that kind of democracy, this kind of liberal, slightly social democracy that I've been talking about. We wanted deeper democracy, more democracy, stronger democracy, meaning more inclusion and more participation. We realized that the neoliberal policies, but also the economic decadence, political decadence, ideological decadence of the elites of the time, it meant that they had kept themselves far away from the majorities, and the majorities weren't represented anymore within the political picture. So we thought that through political means we had to rearrange society. And rearrange society means mass mobilization, means changing our political architecture or structure, changing the constitution, including in people in the decision-making process, participatory democracy is what it's called. And we were waiting and fighting for that for a long time. And it was very difficult and very uncertain process in the sense that nobody had a clear path of where to go. We were finding that by trial and error. In 1998, Chavez won the elections, surfing that wave of discontent against the whole situation. And what we call the revolution, the Bolivarian Revolution began. It meant a process of renegotiation of power between the elites and the majorities. That's what it means today still. It means that the majorities were asking for more power to change their own life, to take charge of their own life. That's what it meant. It still means today. And to do that, in order to do that, to take power, to take control of the political process, to take control of the natural resources, to spend that money that we thought was squandered in our own interests and for our national purposes and for the majority's benefit, we have to take power. We did it through democratic means in 1998, but we changed the constitution, and in that constitution, which is the only, Venezuela has had 26 constitutions during more than 200 years, about 200 years of history. And this is the first one ever that was voted for the people once it was written. It's not that we voted for people to write the constitution and what they wrote, it was okay. It's that after they wrote that thing, they put it again, tested to the will of the people, and we voted that constitution first time in our history. And this constitution is special in the sense that it guarantees these rights I was telling you about, the rights of the minorities, like the rights of the indigenous people, the rights of minorities like women, rights of minorities like the Afro-Venezuelan people that are first time recognized and named even within the constitution, the rights of workers, the rights of peasants, land distribution, redistribution, all these kind of goals that we were talking about for more than 200 years. And they are written, entrenched there in the constitution. But one thing is having a nice notebook full of nice ideas like a constitution that every time I talk to Latin Americans about our beautiful constitution, they laugh at me because they know that in their country constitutions mean nothing. But I'm telling you, in Venezuela, that meant not just a little book, but a massive process of political awareness. Awakening people through that little book, telling them you have right to protest and to ask for more power and to complain to the rulers about the present situation. And that's what Chavez tried to do, react against the whole the past regime, surfing the mass discontent, changing the political structure in order to include the majorities into the social structure. But to do that, you need to take control of the economic resources, meaning oil rent. PDVSA is the most important company in Venezuela, one of the most important in Latin America, and you have to take control of the PDVSA revenues, the revenues of the oil company, and that it meant a massive challenge to the unseen regime in the sense that their power resided precisely in the control, of the oil and the PDVSA revenues. And by changing PDVSA, touching the land property structure and changing the constitution, we touched. We knew, not without inadvertently, it wasn't like that. We knew that we were touching a raw nerve in Venezuelan society. We were touching the pocket of the elites. We were talking what is most important for them. We were displacing them from power. And the reaction was a violent reaction. So I would divide these last 10 years in two, we could divide it in several periods, but two broadly different periods. The one from 1988 up until 2004, which was the period of naivety. We thought that we could talk to the elites and the people who didn't like the change and convince them to come over and join us in marching together to utopia. And then after 2002 and 2004, that we realized that these people, they don't want to do anything with us. And we have to march alone without them having that weight on our shoulders. But we need to do it anyway. Otherwise, we would go back to the former situation. And the second period is the one where the policies were in place and touched reality. The first period is the ideas, the political ideas. The second period, after 2004, we had a massive boom oil, meaning resources, and also political control over the institutions, and then we had the freedom to act. And you could see that most of the things, these nice little ideas I've been telling you about, became not just ideas, but policies. After 2004, meaning social programs, we call them missions, in order to change, radically change, bypassing the bureaucracy, which is also an obstacle within Venezuela, because the old bureaucracy is still there and it's an obstacle, corruption, inefficiency, money, and lack of efficiency. And we need to do something quick, otherwise the people would lose again their expectations and their hope on us. And that's why we put in place social programs in health. I can show you with figures if you want to ask you about more specific programs. I can tell you about health, education, food policies, land distribution, housing. The housing is not a good one, really. It's really bad. I haven't been successful with housing. There are three areas where we have been rubbish. Housing, prison, and the judicial system, corruption. These three things are indefensible. But the rest of them are successful. And successful, if you compare it with two parameters. Successful compared to the Venezuelan past, its own Venezuelan past, and successful if you compare how other Latin American countries behave, and even more successful if you compare how other oil countries spend their oil, you see? Because Venezuela is not a model for countries which have no oil. But oil countries, and Venezuela is an example, the Venezuelan past is an example of that, have squandered their wealth for a long time. And they had many, many chances to do this in the past, but we didn't have the political will or the clarity of ideas, or even the leadership. So the idea is how this oil country, medium-sized, small, I would say, oil country, is changing from within, not asking IMF money or asking the global corporations money, but using its own national and natural resources to change from within. Changing the living conditions, its living standards through political action and mass mobilization and social organization. That's the point. And that's what we are now. We have been through 13 elections, more democratic than ever before in our history. And even we lost one election, meaning that the elections are fair. Those who think that all the elections have been controlled by the government, well, how can we lost one election if everything was controlled by the government? But now, just to sum this up and wind this down to allow you to ask questions, we face new challenges, meaning that this global economic crisis is affecting us as well, because the oil price is cut by a third. It was $150 last year, now it's $50. And we are having less resources to change and to keep the drive within Venezuela, but also something I cannot forget, the drive of our international policy. I know that this is the international policy department. It's important to talk about this. The same values that we are applying within Venezuela, we think are useful to push for our international policy, meaning Latin American integration, social justice, respect for international law, cooperation and solidarity among small countries, anti-imperialism or anti-colonialism, if you want to call it like that, and we call the balance of the equilibrium in international affairs, meaning that we cannot allow for a unipolar world, one single country ruling the rest of the world. All these principles are an expression of what we are trying to do within Venezuela. And I can give you example after example of how we apply these ideas in the international arena. But, of course, oil was there and money was there. But never before you could find a country or Venezuela using its oil in that particular area. For example, let me just give you an example. I always touch this particular program because it's never talked about enough, at least. We have in Venezuela a massive health care program called Barrio Adentro is sending Cubans, doctors, more than 20,000, the best example of cooperation between two Latin American countries ever. Cuba and Venezuela today, more than 20,000 Cuban doctors working in the poorest area of Venezuela. And that particular program has increased our living standard by far. But what few people know is more or less the same program we have been applying it in international arena, meaning Latin America, in a program we call Miracle Operation, and more than 100,000 Latin Americans has been operated on in their eyes by Cuban, Venezuelans, and now Bolivian doctors in different parts of Latin America, saving their eyesight. And that's all paid by Venezuela and work with Cuban doctors. I'm not sure that half of you ever haven't heard of that thing before. And this is the kind of social programs we are trying to apply using oil money, using solidarity, cooperation, as we never had it before. And in that sense, we became, strangely enough, a threat for big powers who, and which always have thought that Venezuela has set a bad example in international affairs. We are the bad kid in the school. We are misbehaving. We are threatening the establishment. We are rocking the boat. So we shouldn't be there. And that's why we suffered in 2002 the first attempted coup d'etat in Latin America in the 21st century. And miraculously, it was defeated. But the point, and this is the whole thing about this book, but the whole thing is that we have been under a media bombardment and hostility, particularly from the Bush administration, that thank God is gone, and for at least 8 years. And what my question is, in what sense Venezuela is a threat to the United States, or to Britain, or whoever else? And the point is that we were a threat in the sense that we were a bad example. And now, I think that most of the things that we were saying in 2001 have been confirmed right, in the sense that the wild neoliberal policies were wrong, the bankers were greedy and had too much power, they were unregulated, the free markets didn't control themselves, and they were bringing poverty to the majority of the planet, and the state had to step in and do something. All of these things we were telling them 8 years ago, and we were labeled crazy, and now I don't think we are. But my point is that, of course, we have made many mistakes and committed many mistakes, but we are no hand going around the world with our hands asking for money and help, and please help us to do. We are making our own mistakes. And this is the first time in our history. We're independent, we're free, and we're free even to make our own mistakes, and thank God for that. I'm going to stop here and let you ask questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Moncada, for that wonderful, spirited survey of Venezuela's past and present. Julie, please.
Well, I normally start any discussion on Venezuela by saying it doesn't matter whether you love or hate Chavez. And you have to say that at any talk on Venezuela, because we either get, over the course of 10 years, people standing up and banging pots and telling us that Chavez is an authoritarian dictator, or we get people standing up and kind of uncritically flag-waving. And the idea that I put to you is that what we actually need in terms of looking at Venezuela is an objective, rational analysis of what this democratically elected government is actually doing. It's something that the Obama administration is wrestling with right now. And by way of kind of building on what the ambassador said and just extending this discussion out slightly, I think there's three key points for me that come out of what the ambassador has just said. Which I'd like to try and build on and use that to try and look at how Venezuela might fare in this current global economic crisis. So I think three things. First of all, drawing on the ambassador, firstly, his mention of the idea of this process of social change and the enormity of social inequalities that that Venezuela has and the region has. And for me, that's always kind of guided me in terms of not trying to understand what's happening in Venezuela in terms of the left and the right, because I don't think that framework really helps to explain developments in the country, but explaining it more in terms of what's happening in the formal sector and what's happening in the informal sector, because those are two manifestly different worlds. The second important point is, as the ambassador talked about, the idea of democracy, that it's not just the freedom to organise, it's also about social rights. And I think why Venezuela has been so hugely important and also terribly threatening for people is the message from Venezuela is that economic empowerment cannot be achieved without political empowerment and vice versa. And this has huge implications for the donor and the development community. What we're currently doing in the UK is having a discussion through organisations like DFID about how best you help the world's poor. And what we've done constantly for the past kind of 10 years of our gracious do-gooding around the world is to work with a model of conditional cash transfers. Now, I don't know how familiar you are with this, but this is essentially, and to make it summarise it in a very crude way, the idea that you give a woman $20 a month if she ensures that her child goes to school. Now, what we're doing at the moment in the UK is revisiting a lot of these basic development principles, because what we're finding is that this kind of donor aid does not break with the structural drivers of poverty. And so what you're increasingly seeing in the donor community is more interest in what Venezuela has done. Because if what Venezuela has delivered in terms of poverty reduction and inequality reduction is sustainable, then there are major and significant lessons for the donor and development community. And then thirdly, the third important point that the ambassador raised was the importance of oil in the Venezuelan economy. So I just want to really try and develop this issue about oil, because one of the arguments that I really want to explore about Venezuela is this notion of petropopulism. I don't really want to dwell too heavily on the economics of where Venezuela's going right now, because I don't think economics are actually important in Venezuela. Everything in Venezuela, to my mind, always comes down to the political. So if you want to explore PDVSA, you want to explore Petrocaribe, ALBA, it's not about the economics. And this is what the United States fundamentally failed to understand when it had this kind of war of antagonism with the country. So firstly then, on petropopulism. If you, over the past 10 years, have read the nefarious rantings of The Economist, which has been particularly poor in its coverage of Venezuela, closely followed by The Guardian, which is also very, very poor in its coverage of Venezuela, you will be led to believe that the popularity of Hugo Chavez has been premised on his capacity to give out all of this oil money that the ambassador talked about before. Now, the reality, though, to my mind, is that petrol is 93% of Venezuela's exports, so they are hugely dependent. And the great irony, obviously, as I'm sure the ambassador would concede, is that oil dependence has increased under President Chavez, and also relations with the United States have become deeper. Venezuela and the US have become closer, despite the rhetoric. So the argument now from The Economist and various magazines is that oil is down about 70% since its peak in July. Okay, it's gone down from $150 to about $45 a barrel. So the idea now, and what The Economist is hoping for, is that there's no oil to give away to people, so they're all going to hate Chavez now, and he's going to fall, and we're going to finally have democracy back in Venezuela. Now, the problem with this argument, and this goes back to what the ambassador was saying before, is that it's based on the assumptions of how boom-bust economics work. And in particular, that argument looks to the 1970s and 1980s, when you had presidents such as Jaime Lucinchi, when you had people like Carlos Andres Perez, who went through a boom period and then this huge bust, which made everybody very unhappy. People rioted, and Chavez, as the ambassador said, surfed the wave to power. Now, the problem with that model is that it's not applicable, to my mind, to what's happening in Venezuela now. Because what happened under the old boom-bust scenario was that the people who suffered the most when the economy went bust was the poor. The difference, to my mind, with this Chavez model is that the poor benefited from the boom, which they didn't do before. It was always the wealthiest sectors of Venezuelan society that benefited, and then the poorest bore the cost of the bust. What's happened now is that the poor had the benefits of the boom, and the government has promised that it will insulate them from the downsides of the bust. And to my mind, and from the work that I do in Venezuela, I think that people in Venezuela who support the government are not driven to support Chavez just because of economic distribution. They support the Chavez government because of non-economic drivers, which I'll go into in a second. The key thing, to my mind, is that Chavez will ride this storm, and we won't have this implosion of the administration, because he has delivered on the promises that he made to ordinary people who are the core of his support. Now, as I said, I don't think the drivers of Chavez's support are material. I think they're political. And what do those entail? Well, if you go back to 1998, the economy was not part of Chavez's agenda. There was no kind of rhetoric against neoliberalism. It was about political change, it was about deepening democracy, and it was about political empowerment of the marginalised sectors. And on all of those counts, the government has delivered. And I think that people will remain loyal to this government throughout this period of bust, and it's going to be very hard for Venezuela, because people think that this government has actually delivered on its commitments. And that's something that has not been done in Venezuela before. Now, just related to that, and kind of developing this theme of how Venezuela is going to go forward, to my mind, if Chavez was somehow removed from power, whether by accident or by design, I think that would be a disaster for Venezuela, because I think the one thing that is keeping Venezuela stable right now through this period of economic turmoil is the central figure of Hugo Chavez. On two counts. Firstly, there is nowhere for disaffected people to go to. And I know it's controversial to say it, but frankly, the opposition is a group of disaffected white males who are fundamentally disconnected from ordinary Venezuelan society. So you will have no group, anti-Chavista group, which will be able to capitalise on any downturn in economic or political support for President Chavez. And related to this, the government is a hugely coherent institution. And if anything, the recent decision to lift presidential term limits in Venezuela, which was seen as hugely controversial for people in the UK for some reason, I think has actually helped Venezuela and will help Venezuela through this period. Because what we always had in Venezuela whenever a presidential election was coming up was this debilitating infighting over who would become the presidential candidate. And it created terrible what we call lame duck scenarios. And so I do think that with this lifting of the constitutional bar, with Chavez being allowed to run again, that is certainly a factor which will really help, to my mind, guide Venezuela through this immediate crisis. And then the final point is that the economic crisis may be severe, but I think Venezuela is actually tremendously well insulated from the rest of the world and the economic fallout from this. So just very quickly, if I've just got time to zip through this, on the economic scenario, as you may know, Venezuela has had this incredible economic growth, particularly since 2003. When we're looking at the government's record, we don't judge it over 10 years because the first 4 years was just a period of conflict and antagonism and very, very little was achieved apart from destabilisation of the economy by its opponents. But what we've seen since 2003 is incredibly strong growth, which when you adjust it for inflation, the economy's grown by about 95% of GDP over a five-year period. So we're looking at annual average growth over that period of, well, you know, 10, 11%, which has been a stunning economic performance. And admittedly, yes, the oil price has gone from 129 at its peak down to under 50 today, but the country has, and we're kind of lacking in transparency here with all respect, but the country is reported to have about $82 billion in international reserves. And in 2008, Venezuela ran a current account surplus of 13.9%. So they have been historically in this strong position. The key message here is that Venezuela right now can finance a current account deficit and it doesn't face the balance of payments constraints which other regional countries and European countries are facing. Also on this, and a point that wasn't mentioned by the ambassador but something that all neoliberals should be very proud of Venezuela achieving, is that the total public debt has fallen from about 31% of GDP to under 15%, and their foreign public debt position is very, very strong. It's down from nearly 26% to 9.8% of GDP. So Venezuela really has the economic fundamentals in place, but it does have to address some severe drags on future economic recovery, which I'll come to in a second. Now, the ambassador said I can give you loads of information about things if you ask, but I'm just going to fill in a couple of gaps there. What has the government done with all of this money? Well, social spending adjusted for inflation between 1998 and 2006 has tripled. Okay, so we have seen this enormous social investment in a country which has no formal and functioning welfare system. Poverty, measured only by cash income, okay, not benefits in terms of education and health, poverty has been halved from 54% of the population in 2003 to 26% by 2008. Extreme poverty has fallen 72%. Now, we can sit here, and I do it very frequently with people who identify with the opposition and say, yes, but you don't factor this in, and you haven't looked at this, and they show me scattergrams, and they have this fantastic quantitative analysis. But the point is that people are actually starting to take what's happening in Venezuela seriously now, and the World Bank have confirmed the figures that have come out, ECLAC have confirmed the figures. So these are the figures that I'm working on, and I take these figures to be authoritative. 70 million people have benefited from Barrio Adentro. They have direct primary health care in their communities. Now, if you're working in Afghanistan or Sierra Leone or Kenya, you want to know how those programs have been delivered, because if you're a donor or a development agency, then there are potential lessons that you can learn from Venezuela. Doctors have they've increased by a factor of 12, medical facilities have doubled, infant mortality has been halved, gross enrollment in education has doubled, social security beneficiaries have doubled. It is quite a stunning record. The key challenge going forward is going to be sustainability. We do have also 4 million more people now who have access to potable water. And as I said, I don't look at these achievements purely in terms of Venezuela. I think these achievements need to be measured on a global scale, and where we can take lessons learned from the country, then we need to do it. The Gini index has improved very, very strongly. It could have been far better improved. For reasons that I'll go into in a second, I think the government has missed a huge opportunity to reduce inequality in the country, and the challenge for them now is making sure that they don't have any kind of regression as they go through the economic crisis. Because what we know in every economic crisis is that normally it's the programs that benefit the poor the most which are the ones that get cut. So what the government has to do now is to make sure that kind of trying to move a counter-cyclical nature against this economic downturn, they don't slash the programs that work the best. Now, just in terms of this adjustment and what Venezuela's facing, Chavez has been one of the few presidents in the region who has actually adjusted his budget. Chavez is infinitely more pragmatic than most of the kind of, you know, neoliberal-oriented actors or right-of-centre actors in the region. Venezuela's adjusted its budget, reduced it by 6.7%. The PDVSA budget has been really strongly cut down. I think it's about 60% of their spending commitments have been reduced. And Chavez has launched this war on corruption. So just in terms of what are the problems that they're facing directly in terms of their economy, because this is quite fundamental to how Chavez weathers the storm, as it were, inflation is a serious challenge for Venezuela right now. And inflation has the potential to erode the benefits that have been delivered to the poorest sectors of society, because I'm sure, as everybody knows, the poorest find themselves in a weaker position in terms of insulating themselves from inflation. The exchange rate is also chronically overvalued. And this seriously needs to be addressed by the government. And there's also an issue about underinvestment in PDVSA and how far Venezuela is assuming that oil fundamentals moving forward are going to be strong. There are signs that the recovery in the oil price might not be happening as sooner or as quicker as we're expecting. But to my mind, the crux of the problems that Venezuela faces, as I said right at the beginning, are not economic, they're political. Venezuela has these abundant reserves, so it doesn't need to go for this, you know, massive and steep devaluation. We're not going to have that kind, same kind of economic fallout. And Chavez does have enormous manoeuvrabilities. The most regressive aspect, to my mind, and it's hugely symbolic and politically problematic for the government, but a big problem, to my mind, is the subsidised petroleum, which all Venezuelans are entitled to. This is a hugely regressive policy. The money that middle-class and wealthy Venezuelans save in having that petrol subsidy could better be distributed to the poorest sectors of Venezuelan society. And more ironically, I think one of the, you know, even though we're told that Chavez is a ranting communist and this frightening populist demagogue, what Chavez has not done is tax the rich as much as they could have taxed them. Certainly compared to frightening communist countries like Sweden, and certainly compared to places like the UK. The wealthy in Venezuela are chronically undertaxed, and if you want to have social cohesion, you need a welfare state, and what that requires is a taxation system which is not regressive and which benefits the poorest sectors of society. Chavez has said that he is going to maintain the misiones, and it looks like financially he is going to be able to do that. But what I think a benefit potentially of this economic crisis is going to be is that it's going to allow the government to rationalise its programmes. It's going to allow for a retrenchment, which I think is necessary. Because with the misiones, the achievements have been phenomenal. But Venezuela now needs to move to stage two, where the issue becomes an issue of quality and not quantity of provision. So it's improving what has been provided. But I think Venezuela can maintain these fiscal outputs. It can sustain the misiones because the heavy investment in terms of infrastructure has already gone in. So I don't think the misiones are as much under threat as people like to think they are, such as the economists. So to my mind, as I said, the problems are non-material, and I think these are the kind of Achilles heel of the Chavez administration. And the ambassador has already mentioned this in his three things we are rubbish at section of his talk. Crime and personal insecurity is a disgrace. Unless Venezuela gets to grips with the situation of crime and insecurity in the country, it's going to completely erode the potential social development aspects of the political model. It's hard to socialise, it's hard to go to community council, it's hard to be an active member of civil society if you think you're going to get shot dead on the way home. What Venezuela also needs is effective project monitoring and evaluation. What they did when they had oil was money was very, very liberally distributed. What you need to do is actually look at what worked well, let's monitor what happened, let's evaluate that project, and let's see where we can build on the successes that we've already had. So project monitoring and evaluation is key. The final point, and hopefully this can broaden this out a bit more to the discussion, is I think the fundamental problem that this government is facing, they'll weather the storm, but they have a dichotomy at the heart of the revolutionary process. And that dichotomy is that macroeconomic policy, which is prudent and pragmatic and is, you know, far more canny than most people actually give them credit for, economic policy runs completely, to my mind, in contradiction to the government's development strategy. In the following ways. If you look at what the government is trying to create at the moment, it is a social economy. It's a hugely praiseworthy, it's a very, very interesting experiment. It's about creating an economy of solidarity where your economy functions on the basis of social need and not purely on profit. So the way they've done this, and it's a fascinating, fascinating insight into democracy and what we mean by democracy, because actually there are alternatives to liberal democracy. It means community councils. It means the thousands of cooperatives that they have in the country. It means their social production economic units. It's a very, very interesting case study in creating an alternative model of democracy. But the fundamental problem that Venezuela has is these will not work if you have an overvalued exchange rate. Because if you have your overvalued exchange rate, it's going to suck the imports in. It's far better to buy a chicken from Brazil than it is to buy a chicken from Venezuela, because the Brazilian chickens are far cheaper because of the exchange rate. So unless you address the fundamentals of the exchange rate, that is going to offset the potentialities of the development strategy that you have in place. And as much as we hear, and this is my final point, as much as we hear all of these issues about, you know, communism, all this kind of thing, Chavez is nationalising, he's taking over land, to my mind a lot of that has actually come from the grassroots. This is a revolutionary process which is driven bottom-up rather than top-down, which is another issue people simply don't engage with. But the final point is that the private sector remained the most powerful, dominant actor in the Venezuelan economy. They were responsible for 90% of imports last year. Now, if the government is to have a socialist model where it controls the commanding heights of the economy, then the reality, to my mind, and to kind of solve the contradictions in its economic policy, is that they need more socialism and more state intervention rather than less. And I think the challenge for the Venezuelan government right now is how they work through that dichotomy. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Boston. That was a really excellent comment and a very good starting point for discussion. While you are collecting your question, let me just follow on from what Julia was saying in her conclusion, is ask the ambassador about the effects of the current global economic downturn or the latest capitalist crisis on what will happen in Venezuela. Because when clearly there is the prospect of a benign recession in the sense that it could set off a refreshment, the term that you used, Julia, but it could actually serve the political aims of the government. But obviously there will also be very severe challenges covering some of the same areas that you ended up on in your conclusion, for instance, with regard to currency issues. Much more difficult to manage, I would assume, in a period of economic downturn than under other circumstances. A bit depends on how you play it, but I mean, at least you have less freedom of action than what you would have. What do you see as the most immediate challenges, Mr. Ambassador, that comes out of the current global downturn?
Okay, the first thing is that we have plenty of inefficiencies within our model that have to be corrected immediately. For example, oil price is one of them, in the sense, let me just give you an example. Oil is very cheap in Venezuela to produce, I mean. But to produce an oil, a liter of petrol, gasoline, it costs for Venezuelan refineries around 500 bolivars, which is around 25 cents of a dollar in official terms, less in the black market dollar. But anyway, let's say 25 cents of a dollar to produce 1 liter of gasoline. And we sell it at around 5 cents. So we are selling our own petrol, gasoline, on pump stations 5 times less or 4 times less than it costs us to produce. And for example, let me give you an example. Right now we have we have 6 or 7 big refineries, and the biggest refinery in the whole world is in Venezuela. But at this moment it needs maintenance, so it's shut down, and it's going to be shut down for several months. So we don't have enough petrol to satisfy our own, to supply our own market. So right at this moment in time, we are buying petrol abroad. I don't know what price, it should be at $75 per barrel or something like that, because it's petrol, it's not just it's gasoline, not just crude oil, and sell it at 5 cents in the internal market, which is silly, because we could find Venezuelan petrol in the pump stations in Ecuador and Panama, because it's so cheap to contraband that thing. There are, for example, tuna fleets in Venezuela that they buy diesel in order supposedly to cross the Panama Channel and go to the Pacific to fish tuna, but they stop in the middle of the Caribbean Sea and sell the diesel and come back to Venezuela, because it's cheaper to sell the diesel instead of buying fish tuna, you see what I mean? So there are many, many inefficiencies around the subsidy. And the other thing is our public enterprises, or public companies, industrial companies down south Venezuela. For example, last year apparently the ton of aluminium costs in the international market around $3,000. Right now, because of the global downturn, it is $1,300. $3,000, $1,300. We produce that aluminium at $5,000. Why? Because there are many costs included with trade unions, and we had some managers, it's very nice, one friend of mine who was minister also, a very wise man, he says that it's very, very, what I want to say sounds silly, but it's not, if you are in power, it's very different to ask for water than to supply water. Absolutely different. So we appointed in many of these companies very veteran and mature revolutionary leaders who fought even during the guerrilla times, during the 60s, and they know everything about Marx and Lenin. And when they are being managers of an aluminium company, they think that their job in life is to produce happiness for their workers, and they say so exactly. You cannot measure my results with the capitalist measure. You have to see that my purpose in life is to produce happiness for the communities that are working here. So the result of that we're producing aluminium at $5,000 per ton, and we have to sell it at $1,300 in the international market, which is ridiculous. So we have to tight the screws in many, many areas. But I would say it's not that difficult. You know why? Because there are so many excesses in our inefficiencies in our public expenditure. You could cut easily 30% of that expenditure today without affecting the core social programs easily, because there are many inefficiencies. But that means a political debate.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And making the majorities to understand that we are not immune to the economic global crisis.